stage again, this time with Jeff Bezos. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
I'm happy to be here.
We only have limited time with Jeff, so I'm going to dive right in. Dave Limp told us about your library.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about builders versus dreamers?
Builders and dreamers. Well, the framework there is pretty simple. You know, the dreamers come first. They inspire, so that they cite fiction authors. You know, Alexa was inspired by the Star Trek computer. So the dreamers come, the builders get inspired by them, and the builders build. And the builders build a new foundation that the dreamers can stand on and dream more. And by the way, when I describe it that way, it sounds like I'm talking about different people. There's this set of dreamers over here and this set of builders over here. But actually, they are often in one body, and everybody is a dreamer and everybody is a builder, and they come in different proportions and in different ways. We all have that capacity. That's a very human capacity to dream and build and get that spinning. The dreamers can't continue to dream new things until the builders build. They stand on each other, on each other's shoulders.
So I've been at Amazon a while. We talk about leadership principles all the time, and I've heard you say that your favorite is write a lot.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds
like people who are write a lot. Yeah.
That sounds like a great idea. Right? But how do you write a lot?
Well, that of course is a great question, because you know, when you say somebody be write a lot, that is not super helpful. It's kind of an obvious desire without any ideas behind it. But I pay attention to people, I observe people who are right a lot, and I have detected some patterns. But people who are right a lot, they listen a lot. They also change their mind a lot, which is very interesting, because I observe it in politics, for example, that if you change your mind, you're a flip-flopper, and you're kind of immediately disqualified. But the people that I observe who write a lot change their mind a lot. And sometimes I explain that, some people say, yeah, when you get new data, you change your mind. And I agree with that. But what I have found is sometimes people who write a lot change their mind even without getting new data. They have the same data set that they had at the beginning, but they wake up and they reanalyze things all the time, and they come to a new conclusion, and then they change their mind. The world is so dynamic that if you don't change your mind frequently, you're just by definition going to be wrong a lot. That is true. And then the last thing that I notice about people who write a lot is they work very hard to discipline themselves, they want to disconfirm their most fundamentally, you know, foundational biases. And this is very unnatural for human beings. We are very selective in our evidence gathering. If we have a going-in bias, we look for evidence that confirms that bias. This is just a very human thing to do, and it does lead you to be wrong a lot. And instead, if you can say, okay, I hold this idea very firmly, and I know I hold it firmly, so I'm going to actively try to look for evidence to disconfirm that idea. If you can do that, you're going to be right more often.
I think we can all agree this Amazon thing, it seems to be working for you. What if it weren't? What would you be doing?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad it is working. That is good. I love my job. I tap dance into the office. If Amazon had worked out, I'd probably be an extremely happy software engineer.
You know?
No. Certainly not twice. No. Seriously, I get told all the time. I seek it out. Go ahead. Sorry, I'm interrupting you.
So, do you ever have trouble winning support for any of your ideas?
Winning support for my ideas. You know, this is the answer is yes. You know, if I have a new idea that I am in love with and I want to see it pursued, I do have to build support for it, just like anybody would, because you need very smart people to embrace the idea and move it forward. We have a framework in Amazon, so one of our leadership principles is called disagree and commit. And that is extremely useful. Because after you discuss an idea, you do need to make a decision and move forward. And people, the whole team needs to really commit to that, even if they actually disagree with it. And the important thing to note about that, though, is it works in both directions. It's not always the boss who says, you have to commit with me. It's often, and this is true of me very frequently, that I will disagree. I'll be the one who disagrees and commits. There's a lot of reasons for that. One, if you're walking down the street and five people come up to you and tell you you're drunk, and you know you haven't had a drink in a year, you should still go lie down. You know, there's something going on. And so that is... So that's important. But the other thing is often you're working with people who are just as passionate as you are. They have their own set of ideas. And often, if you're the boss, the person that you're talking to may have better ground truth than you do. So even if maybe you have a different experience set, maybe in some ways your experience set is even more relevant, you're not going to have access to the same ground truth that the person who's working for you has on that topic. And so the boss should be the one to disagree and commit. When I really feel strongly about something and the team disagrees with me, I have a phrase that I like to use, which is helpful, which is, I want you to gamble with me on this. It's very different from phrasing that in the right, because the truth is, when you're in a position like that where nobody knows what the right answer is, you're not saying, I'm right on this, go do this. You're saying, I want you to gamble with me on this, because I don't know if it's right either. But I want, will you do that? And then people really will disagree and they really will commit. And that saves a lot of time. You know, if you really had to get the very last person in the room to have consensus on the idea, have genuine consensus, it might never happen, and you also might waste a lot of time. So that's a very valuable thing to be able to do. I disagree with you all the time. And I promise the people when I do it, I'm very clear, I don't agree with this. I think it's probably not going to work. But I will never say I told you so, but I'm going to be on your team. I will do everything I can to make it work.
If I had a crystal ball, what would you predict in the next 10 years?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so predictions on a 10-year time frame are hard to make and often wrong. The only good thing about making 10-year predictions is nobody goes and checks. It's also one of the safest things to do.
I thought this was on the record.
Yeah, it's on the record, but it'll be 10 years from now. I think you can foresee some things in the 10-year time frame. We just saw one. If I had to, I think grasping is going to be a solved problem in the next 10 years, even in a commercial way. It's funny, too. I think if you went back in time 30 or 40 years and asked roboticists and computer scientists, people working on machine learning at that time, which problem would be harder to solve, machine vision, natural language understanding, or grasping? I think most people would have predicted that we would solve grasping first. And of course, it's turned out to be an incredibly difficult problem, probably in part because we're starting to solve it with machine vision, so maybe machine vision did have to come first. But it's a very, very challenging problem that's been solved. Outside of my arena of expertise, I think we're going to see amazing developments in biotechnology over the next 10 years. I think that's been an incredible field, and we'll see dramatic progress there. We'll continue to see lots of progress in machine learning and AI. It's interesting, I do get asked quite frequently what's going to change in the next 10 years. A question that I rarely get asked, and it's probably even more important, and I encourage each of you in your own businesses to think about this, is the question, what's not going to change in the next 10 years? Because the answer to that question can allow you to organize your activities. You can work on those things with the confidence to know that all the energy you put into them today is still going to be paying you dividends 10 years from now. So in our e-commerce business, for example, I know, you know, 10 years from now, people are going to want low prices. 10 years from now, people are going to want fast shipping. People are going to want, you know, big selection. These kinds of things are stable in time. They're not going to change. It's impossible to imagine that 10 years from now, someone would say, Jeff, I love Amazon. I just wish you delivered a little more slowly. I love Amazon. I just wish your prices were a little higher. And so when you identify those big ideas that are stable in time, they are not going to change. And they're usually customer needs, by the way. Other things change very, very dynamically. Your competitive set changes very dynamically. The technologies that you can employ change very dynamically. And so if you are basing a strategy on things that change dynamically, like who your competitors are and what their activities are, you're going to have to be changing your strategy all the time. Whereas if you base it on customer needs that are stable in time, you can put you can spin up flywheels around those things and have all of that. Okay, what can we do to deliver faster? What can we do to have lower cost structure so that we can offer lower prices? So on and so on. So that's a really important question to ask. You should ask yourselves, in my business, what is stable in time? What's not going to change? And by the way, you don't ever have to do a lot of research on that because you know the answers. As soon as you think about it that way, these things are so big and so fundamental, you can just write the answers down. You know it. But then you just need to organize your organization to put energy into this.
Been so many big ideas talked about here over the last couple days. Can you tell us a bit more about what's a big bet that we've taken recently at Amazon?
Well, I mean, the recent one is would be Project Kuiper. This is our LEO satellite constellation. This is the goal here is broadband everywhere. But the very nature of you put thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit. It's very different from geostationary satellites. And one of the things it does is just the way that the systems work, you have equal broadband all over the surface of Earth. Not exactly equal. It tends to be a little bit more concentrated toward the poles, unfortunately. But you end up servicing the whole world. And so it's really good. It, by definition, you end up accessing people who are kind of under bandwidth, you know, rural areas, remote areas, and I think you can see going forward that internet to broadband, access to broadband is going to be very close to being a fundamental human need as we move forward. So Project Kuiper has that. It's also very good business for Amazon because it's a very high CapEx undertaking. It's multiple billions of dollars of CapEx. And so we need to be doing things, and Amazon is a large enough company now that we need to be doing things that if they work, can actually move the needle.
I have a prayer for money. I have been inside Amazon's chicken farm where animals are critically used in a mass manipulation. Can you actually talk to your father and ask for your commitment to stop Amazon and its food and animal needs? I'm here to protect your very non-violent manner. Jeff, please, you're the richest man on the planet. You can help them.
Do you have a response to that?
I wasn't quite prepped for that,
Jeff. I'm sorry, where were we?
We're talking about Project Kuiper.
We need to be doing things where if they work, they have to be able to move the needle for us. We can't do things that if they work, they'll be small.
So the opposite side of big bets is everything doesn't work. How do you know when to throw in the towel?
Well, this is a great question. This may be one of my worst things. I'm very, very stubborn on the big ideas. I'm flexible on the details, but I don't like to give up on things that we're working on. And I have figured out the best answer that I have come up with to when to throw in the towel. So you do a lot of things. Many of them are going to fail. So how do you know when to stop? You're pounding your head against the wall, and your head is losing. How do you know when to stop? What I do is I look around the room, and when the last high judgment champion has thrown in the towel, it's time to stop. Oftentimes that's me, by the way. I'm like, no, let's give it one more try. But sometimes it's not me, and there's somebody else in the room, another executive, who isn't ready to throw in the towel. And I've known this person for decades. The team that I work with has been very stable, and I know their judgment is great, and they still think there's hope there, opportunity there, and so we'll keep funding that thing. So, but that's a good way to do it.
So we all know that you own another company, space company, Blue Origin.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about why the moon?
Well, so we are, we're working, we have a program called Blue Moon. We're building a lunar lander and working to return to the moon. The moon turns out to be a resource-rich neighbor of Earth that we now know so much about the moon that we didn't know during the Apollo program, or even really 20 or 30 years ago. We know that there is water in the form of ice in the currently shadowed craters on the poles of the moon. And that is a very vital resource because you can, among other things, make rocket propellant out of it. And the moon has a very low gravity well. It's 6 times less than Earth's. And it takes 24 times less energy to lift a pound off of the moon than it does to lift a pound off of the Earth. So that's a big lever. And the moon is close to the Earth, which is very handy. So it's only three days away. And you have unlimited launch opportunities. You don't have to wait 20 months or more between launch opportunities. So it's logistically a very good place to go. And to do big things in space, we need to use in-space resources. And so the moon is great. The reason we go to space, in my view, is to save the Earth. We are going to continue to grow this civilization. We need to move, and I'm talking about something that, you know, our grandchildren will work on, and their grandchildren, and so on. This isn't something that this generation is going to accomplish. But we need to move heavy industry off Earth. It'll be way better done in space anyway. Access to power is going to be way easier in space. And Earth will be zoned residential and light industry. And that's our future. And we need to do that. That's important if we want to keep growing. And if we need to preserve this planet. We have sent robotic probes now to every planet in the solar system. This is the good one. It's not close. And we need to protect it. And we can do that by going to space. And the number one thing that we need to do is have truly operational, reusable launch vehicles. If we can do that, it can't be reusable only in name. You can't bring it back and have to inspect everything and take it apart and x-ray, you know, and reassemble it. That's just too expensive. You have to have them designed from the beginning to be reusable, like commercial airliners. And then you can really change our trajectory in space. And that's expensive. So the objective to get infrastructure is always expensive. Amazon was easy to start in 1994 with a small amount of capital because the transportation system already existed. It was called U.S. Postal Service, Deutsche Post, and Royal Mail. We didn't have to build a transportation network. It was already in place. Would have been billions of dollars of CapEx. The payment system existed. It's called the credit card. There were already a telecom network that had been built for long-distance phone calls that had existed, so the internet could provide on top of that. That would have been billions of dollars. The infrastructure to do something like Amazon or Facebook, is an even better example, literally started in a dorm room. You cannot start an interesting space company today from your dorm room. And so the price of admission is too high. And the reason for that is the infrastructure doesn't exist. So my mission with Blue Origin is to help build that infrastructure, the heavy lifting infrastructure, so that future generations will be able to stand on top of it the same way I stood on top of the U.S. Postal Service and so on. That's critical, and that's all about reusability. And then the second piece we need is those resources on the moon so we can lift them off.
Think we'll ever have Amazon fulfillment centers on the moon?
That's a very been questioned. I haven't really contemplated that. We'll start out delivering, you know, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. It's going to be a small selection, but a very important one.
We actually have time for one more question.
Okay.
I know we have a number of entrepreneurs in the room.
Yeah.
What advice would you give anyone in the room who's looking to start their own business?
I get asked this question from time to time, and there are a few pieces of it. If you want to be an entrepreneur, the most important thing is to be customer obsessed. So don't satisfy your customers. Figure out how to absolutely delight them. That is the number one thing. Whoever your customers are. Passion. You have got to have some passion for the arena that you're going to develop the work in. Because otherwise you're going to be competing against people who do have passion for that, and they're going to build better products and services. You can't be a mercenary, you have to be a missionary. Missionaries build better products and services, they always win. The mercenaries are just trying to make money. And paradoxically, the missionaries always end up making more money. You have to pick something that you actually have a genuine passion for. You have to take risk. You have to be willing to take risk. If you aren't going to take risk, if you come for the business idea, there's no risk there, you're probably, you know, it's probably already been done. Those ideas have already been done. They've been done well by many, many people. So you've got to have something that might not work. And so you have to accept that your business is going to be, in many ways, an experiment. It might fail. And that's okay. That's what risk is. The good news is in Amazon, we still take risks all the time, and we encourage it. We talk about failure. We should be failing. Our failures have to grow with the company. We need big failures if we're going to be moving the needle. We need to have, you know, billion-dollar scale failures. And if we're not, we're not swinging hard enough. But I'll tell you the great, you know, everybody knows if you go to the plate and swing hard, you're going to hit more home runs, but you're also going to strike out more often. The thing that's different, where that metaphor really breaks down, is that in business, when you're inventing something, when you swing hard in baseball, the maximum number of runs you can get is 4. In business, every once in a while, when you swing hard, you get 1,000 runs. So the risk is capped on the downside. And for all practical purposes, it's unlimited on the upside. And as a result, you really should, because of that, the way that probability distribution is, you really should be swinging hard. And you are going to fail a lot, and it's okay. And you need to have a culture that supports that. So that's what I would advise. That's a few things that you can think about and see how they apply inside your own business. And by the way, everything I just laid out does not have to be at a startup. It works at Amazon, it'll work. You can work at a Fortune 100 company, and you should still have an entrepreneurial mindset. And you should preach that inside your company, you should lead that inside your company, you should encourage your teammates to take risks and be customer obsessed. All those things work just as well inside of a company as they do inside of a startup.
Jeff, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for the question.
Yes.
Thank you guys for coming.